This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest today is Bobby Short, America's most celebrated Cafe Society singer. His vast repertoire is like a history of American popular song, from early Kern and Berlin to recent Sondheim. His performances and records have kept alive Porter and Gershwin favorites and have revived many of their forgotten gems. This is a selection from one of Bobby Short's first albums, recorded in the late 1950s. The song is Fun to be Fooled, with music by Harold Arlen and a lyric by Ira Gershwin and Yip Harburg.
Spring is here. I'm a fool if I fall again. And yet, I'm intrigued by love's call again. You say you love me. I know from the past. You mean to love me, but these things don't last. Fools rush in to begin new love affairs. But tonight, tonight, my dear, who cares? Fun to be fooled, fun to pretend, fun to believe love is unending. Thought I was done, still it is fun to be fooled again. Nice when you tell all that you feel. Nice to be told this is the real thing. Fun to be kissed, fun to exist, to be fooled again. It's that old devil moon having his fling once more, selling me spring once more. I'm afraid love is king once more. Fun to be fooled, fun to pretend. This little dream won't end. Once more, fun to be fooled, fun to pretend this little dream won't end.
That was Fun to be Fooled, with Bobby Short singing and accompanying himself at the piano. Since 1968, Bobby Short has performed at the elegant New York club, the Café Carlyle, where he's come to represent Manhattan sophistication. That image wasn't lost on Revlon, which got him to sing their Charlie Perfume ad on television. The commercial introduced Short to an audience that wasn't necessarily concerned with neglected pop songs. Short is not a native of the high society that embraced him. He grew up in the small town of Danville, Illinois, where his mother was active in the church and made her living as a domestic. Short played roadhouses and the vaudeville circuit before reaching puberty. Bobby Short told me that when he was a child, jazz was frowned on by the church, but he listened anyway.
Jazz was preached against every Sunday morning in church, and it was awfully difficult to keep jazz out of the house because of the radio and phonograph records around. But my mother made a very, very interesting distinction. There was a very popular recording around in the 1930s or late 1920s called Shake That Thing. And it was a blues that Ethel Waters had recorded. And I remember now very clearly that we had a recording of that song in the house, but it was instrumental. We didn't have the words.
So if it didn't have the words, it was okay?
It was all right, yes.
Did it make that kind of music even more exciting to you because it was a little sinful almost?
Well, anything forbidden, of course, was exciting. I mean, there was not one mother in the neighborhood who would have denied her daughter the chance to go to a dance. At the same time, they all went to church on Sundays, and they were told about how dancing was wicked and jazz music was really awful. But there were many people in America then who preached that jazz was the work of the devil. Henry Ford did not like jazz.
What kind of neighborhood was Danville where you grew up?
It was very interesting. I was just in Danville a week ago, and it's changed so enormously. We lived in an enclave in the north end of town. That was a little black enclave. And even inside those boundaries, there were white families sprinkled generously. I was in Danville just last week, and all that has changed. First of all, the enclave has spread out enormously into areas where Negroes could not buy property when I was growing up. And it is almost totally black. We were one-tenth of the population in Danville. We all had houses with front yards and backyards. The schools were integrated in Danville, and I was very often the only black child in my class.
Were you looked down on at all for that?
Goodness, no. I think within that minority, there was an enormous amount of strength and pride. And we grew up as though we were wasps. I didn't know what a Jewish person was until I left Danville. My two agents were Jewish. And when I came back, of course, I was quite sophisticated about people not all being the same.
What do you mean you grew up like wasps?
Well, our whole framework for existing, our whole society, was based upon the WASP precept of getting on in the world. There were all kinds of barriers, of course, that we could not cross, but in every way we were like WASPs. We went to Protestant churches because in the beginning it was the Protestants who undertook the education of the black people in the South. And so we became Baptists and Methodists and Episcopalians, and there were a number of Catholics in Danville who were black, but they were odd too.
Did you go to a lot of movies, and were you kind of attracted by the style and sophistication that was shown in a lot of the musicals?
Oh, I believe I certainly was. Yes, I was at the movie house every Sunday afternoon, and sometimes on Saturdays as well.
Did that give you a sense of what it would be like to live in a very sophisticated world? Did you have a lot of fantasies that you built from the movies that you saw when you were young?
Well, I think so. And I think that not since the 30s have the movies been quite so stylish. They were really stylish in those days with ocean liners and yachts and penthouses and champagne and evening clothes. It was pretty grand.
Do you feel like you're living that kind of life now?
No, I don't. I think I'm living the kind of life that I live today.
If your mother was kind of strict about what kind of music you went to hear, how did you end up playing in roadhouses and saloons when you were nine?
Well, you have to remember that back in those days, there was a deep, deep depression spread over America, and money was awfully hard to come by. And the fact that I could earn money made a lot of things different. I'm reminded of a story that Ruby Blake used to tell. Ruby Blake, the old composer and pianist, who said that his mother one day found out he was playing in a house of prostitution. He was making, I guess, $16 a week or something. He was just a baby playing in this house of prostitution, I guess, somewhere in the South. And his mother one day said, "I'm going to tell your father." So she told his father, and his father said, "How much are you making?" And when he told him, the story changed altogether. The whole situation changed.
So were you supporting your mother by playing in saloons?
Not supporting her, but I was certainly taking care of myself and bringing money home to her, too.
What kind of material were you playing when you were a child?
Jazz. Oh, pure jazz. We played all the popular songs in the saloons. People danced. And then when I was 12, I left Danville and I became involved in honest-to-goodness vaudeville.
And what were you doing there?
I was playing the piano and singing then, but I was in a white tail suit, you see, on the stage, and I performed with great dignity, and I was a child performer.
Did you have to learn to tap dance and things like that?
Oh, no. I think every other colored kid in America, I say colored because that was the word they used in those days, on the stage tap danced. I could never learn the tap dance very well. And I played the piano and sang. I was given lessons constantly. I could not learn to dance. And I played and sang, though, and I had my white tail suit. I performed on vaudeville stages around the Midwest and part of the East.
Were you singing songs with sophisticated and world-weary lyrics when you were 12?
Well, it was difficult in those days to find songs that were exactly suitable for a 12-year-old. There were a couple of kids around in those days performing, and so whenever big star kids, I mean, like Judy Garland and Bobby Breen and Deanna Durbin and Harold Nicholas, and whenever they sang a song, I think, well, this is appropriate for me to sing. But it was not easy to find songs for a kid to sing. Of course, I preferred to sing about smoking and drinking and never thinking of tomorrow.
What did it mean to you, though?
Oh, it just meant sophistication, I suppose, and grown up, which, of course, I was not. But my mind was very receptive to sophisticated music. And so, of course, it didn't matter to me about the lyrics. I just thought they were something that went along with the music.
Had you taken piano lessons?
Not really. I'm self-taught. Mainly. And at one point during my very early years at the piano, my mother thought that I should take lessons. Because in those days, every household had a piano, and always somebody in the household played the piano. And my mother played the piano a tiny bit. All the renders, all that's my mother's family, were musical to some degree.
What about voice lessons?
I didn't get around to that until I was in high school. Then I was part of various singing groups, and my first awareness of what it was to produce a sound the proper way came from my old vocal coach in high school.
Did you change your singing after the coaching?
No, you don't change your singing. You just change the way you go about it.
Change the breathing and all
yes,
that?
Yes, of course. Your enunciation, the way you go about hitting a vowel or holding on to a consonant, you know.
Well, you have extraordinary enunciation. Do you credit any of that to your vocal coach?
My vocal coach, and I think my good ear and really whiz-bang high school education in Danville, Illinois.
Are there any, like, secrets to enunciating without doing anything that really exaggerates the language too much?
I think there are tricks, and those tricks are some of the things that I learned from my old music teacher in Illinois at Danville High School. I think there are ways to go about pronouncing certain sounds, certain vowel sounds, that make the sounds less offensive, because sometimes an ow sound can sound terrible. And you don't want to let you learn to say now instead of now. And you learn to grab onto those consonants as quickly as you possibly can. And there are ways. And, you know, it's interesting. I have a lot of recordings at home of musical movie stars, people like Dick Powell and Irene Dunne. And it's amazing how well they enunciated. They had obviously had very, very, very good training, because every single word comes right across. And that, of course, is the test, isn't it?
Where do you put your T's?
T's and P's can be a problem for a singer, and they can be very explosive. I have to learn to control all of that, because I want to be precise, and so I say T and P, and that's not very nice. It comes out like pow, pow, pow.
What about S's?
That's difficult, too. I think people sometimes have a natural tendency toward sibilance with S's, and so I've never had too much of an S sound about my speech. I don't believe I have.
You were telling us a couple of minutes ago that you took voice lessons, but you're self-taught at the piano. Do you know how to read music? Did you teach yourself
how
to do
that? Not really very well at all. And I have such respect now for the music that I play that I don't rely upon myself at all to take a song and learn it cold. If I'm really in difficulty, I'll call in a pianist to teach me the song.
And they'll sit down and...
Sit down and show me the proper chords, and I have this indestructible memory, which has helped me all these years.
I figure you must, because you're, you know hundreds and hundreds of songs.
Yes.
Do you ever blank out on the words?
I have a few times, but most of the time I have a computer inside somewhere. If I just press the right combination of numbers, it all comes rolling right out again after years and years and years of neglect.
Well, they say whether it's true or not that Louis Armstrong started scatting because he forgot the words once.
Oh, what a brilliant mistake, though. What a wonderful happenstance.
When did you start actually developing the repertoire that you're famous for now of popular song standards, Rodgers and Hart, Cole Porter, the Gershwins, Irving Berlin?
I began that as soon as I knew about it. I heard a funny story about a young lady from Mississippi who had moved to New York, and somebody said, "When did you first go to New York?" She said, "As soon as I heard about it." And as soon as I heard about Rodgers and Hart, I didn't know a thing about Rodgers and Hart in Danville, Illinois. Cole Porter was a name we all knew about, but we didn't know about Rodgers and Hart. We didn't know about Arthur Schwartz and Howard Dietz. We knew about George Gershwin, of course, and Rhapsody in Blue and Porgy and Bess. But the people who were the mainstays on the Broadway musical stage were unknown to us in a small town like Danville. And the Broadway stage itself was completely unknown to us. We didn't know about such things as Broadway musicals, live performers on the stage. But as soon as I left Danville, I learned about those things, and it became an all-consuming interest with me, and I set about learning all I could possibly learn.
Could you tell what attracted you to those songs, why you knew that was it and not Boogie Woogie and not the blues?
I don't know. I felt that I was better equipped to... I've always had a great fondness for the language, and then I had 4 years of English in high school, which should tell you something. And I've always been attracted to words and the putting together of phrases and sentences. And I used to write poetry when I was a child. And I felt that to sing these songs was not going to wear me out and bore me. And so I learned them. It wasn't easy because my agents at the time would have had a much easier time promoting a black boy who played Boogie Woogie and sang than a young black boy who was singing the latest hits from some obscure Cole Porter show on Broadway. But I'd learned the rudiments of performing when I was a child, and so I was always entertaining the people, and it didn't much matter with what I was entertaining them, so long as I entertained them.
You have been at the Cafe Carlyle since 1968.
Yes.
Can you tell us the story of how you first became the pianist and singer there?
Oh, it's not a big story. It's just that I was called in when the new owner, Peter Sharp, owned the hotel. He called me in one day to take the place of his vacationing pianist who'd been there for a long time. And I was a great success in the room. And so, of course, they asked me if I'd come back and play an engagement there. And, of course, I wanted to because I'd always wanted to work at the Cafe Carlyle. And with that, I believe they offered their steady pianist half the year and me the other half of the year. And he did not like that arrangement at all. And so they gave the whole year to me, which I quickly altered to suit my own capacities.
My guest is Bobby Short, if you're just joining us. What do you see your role as being in American popular music?
Oh, I don't know. I am so shy about trying to put a label on myself. I just think that I play and sing what I like, and I don't attach any long-term importance to it. It's given me pleasure, it's earned me a comfortable living, and it's entertained a lot of people, I suppose, over the years. But I don't look upon myself as some kind of prophet or paragon of invention or whatever, you know. I'm kind of a keeper of the flame, I suppose.
One of the things you've done for me as a listener is introduce me to songs that I fear I wouldn't otherwise have found out about, and then, you know, kept songs alive that I've really enjoyed, too. How do you find the songs that are the lesser-known gems that you perform?
Well, I have a rather good ear for things like that. And then, of course, if it gets around that you're into songs like that, people who have access to them are all too willing to bring them to you. Many of the songs that I learned in the 1940s were brought to me by people who had heard them in shows or who loved them and hadn't heard them since they'd seen the show. I was lucky enough to meet people who had written some of those songs, and of course they brought their songs to me people like Burton Lane and Cole Porter.
What did Cole Porter bring to you?
Oh, goodness, I can't even think. But he certainly gave me lots of extra lyrics to things.
Did you ever perform when Cole Porter was in the room?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Many times.
Did he have a way that he liked his songs interpreted?
Well, I never found him fidgety about his songs being interpreted by performers. I never found him demanding or too critical. Many composers are. But this was a very level-headed, I believe, very democratic man, Cole Porter. And I think that he was always aware of the fact that he came from Piru, Indiana. I think more and more that he was aware of that. And from a little society, a very socially ambitious mother. But he was not a part automatically of the society that he sought or that took him up. And I think he remembered all of those humble beginnings. I don't mean humble in terms of poverty, because he was not poor ever. But let's face it, coming from the Midwest and going off to crash into Eastern society back in those days just wasn't being done very often.
It's funny because his songs really define that kind of society, and he wasn't even from it.
And so that is another thing that I've thought about a lot. I think that not being part of it gave him a chance to be objective about it more than he could have been had he been part of the society.
Isn't that true of you in a way, too? Because you were an outsider to New York.
Absolutely.
High society.
Absolutely.
And now you've become a symbol of it.
Well, not really. Not ever really a part of it. But I think that I share that with Cole Porter a great deal.
You said that some composers are real sticklers, though, about how you interpret. They're very strict
absolutely.
About how you interpret. Who are some of them?
Well, many of them are strict in a very, very nice way. Stephen Sondheim is strict, but never gruff, never unattractive. He might suggest to you that you change the chord, or that word, that was not still, Bobby, it was yet, you know, that sort of thing. One of my great friends is Cy Coleman, who was the same way. Lovely. Good musician, as is Stephen, of course, and will tell you. But I think most of all that composers like Sondheim and Cole Porter and Cy Coleman were just delighted that people were singing their songs. And unless they were total abominations, they would always stand on the sideline and applaud.
Did you ever have the opportunity of meeting Richard Rodgers?
Yes, I did. I met Richard Rodgers at the time that I recorded the Rodgers and Hart double LP.
So it's interesting to me that you have chosen to record a double LP of Rodgers and Hart as opposed to Rodgers and Hammerstein. Do you think of Rodgers' composing style as having changed when Hammerstein became his lyricist?
Enormously. Oh, I think so. Became much more straightforward. It was always full of marvelous surprises when he wrote with Larry Hart. There were things that happened musically that were just astounding, and his inspiration, his source, seemed never to run dry. It was incredible, the tunes in his head, the ideas, the formations. It was remarkable.
Do you think his composing became more conventional?
I think much more conventional, and I think he wanted to become that way.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think that Richard Rodgers is always a very, very good businessman.
Do you wish you had a chance to meet Larry Hart?
Oh, I think I'd have liked meeting him very, very much. The people I know who knew him say many, many things about Larry Hart. Among them, the fact that he was a very, very lonely, very unhappy person. But I think I'd like to have met him. I mean, what a mind, what a brain.
Do you have a favorite of his lyrics?
Not really, but I understand his style, and I can identify it almost without trying. And many of his songs I like enormously. I like the way he was always, like Cole Porter, he was always very topical. He used people and situations at the moment to make his songs work.
Does that ever trouble you now when there's something that rhymes with had a hopper in it or something, and it's clearly a reference to something that happened 40 years ago?
Well, I try very, very hard to stick as close to the song as written as possible. And I may explain who Peggy Joyce is to a young audience, but I think that taking the liberty of putting in your own lyrics is just the biggest bore in the world. I mean, I don't want to hear about, and South Pacific is a terrific show, they say. I don't like that kind of thing.
Is Broadway producing songs that you like to sing now?
Not really. There's been nothing to come to Broadway in a long time with a score that I think is altogether attractive. Think of how many show albums were sold with The Sound of Music, for instance, or West Side Story, or Kiss Me, Kate. Show albums. And think of all the spin-offs. Think of all the jazz versions and all the Spanish versions of My Fair Lady. And it went on and on and on and on and on. When Richard Rodgers wrote the score, that is, words and music, both, for a show called No Strings, Atlantic Records, when we recorded at the time, put together what they called a supper club version of the score. And with Herbie Mann and Laverne Baker, I recorded the whole score in dance tempo.
Have your friends or fellow performers ever urged you to get with it and sing the now song, sing the songs of today?
Well, I went through a very, very bleak period in the 1960s when Beatlesitis took over the universe. And it was very tough going for a while. And it was amazing how many people came to me and said, look, if you want me to finance you, I'll finance you. You can buy yourself an act. That was the act. That was the idea. Then you bought an act. You got a choreographer and you got an act, learned some new songs and went out to Las Vegas, I suppose, and earned zillions of dollars a week. I was asked to record this and record that and to change my style and to change other things about myself, the way I dressed, the way I looked, the way I presented myself. And it was very interesting, but I held on and stuck to my guns and managed to survive.
Were you, was it suggested that you start wearing jumpsuits? And
well, costumes, you know, just something smart from Saint Laurent. Something in velvet or, you know, a coverall in silk or whatever, just something far out.
But you don't expect to ever change either your repertoire or your
I don't think so.
Style of singing.
I don't think so. There's danger in that at this point. I think that what it is that I've become is a fairly solidly founded thing, and it's certainly regarded by people who support me as something solid. And to move out of that into something else would be a shock. Not only to my supporters and my fans, but also to my own sense of integrity.
That was singer Bobby Short, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air.